Oh, no, that was not me. Huh? Oh, that's good. Good morning. It's good to be with you guys at the end of this. We've had issues with this before. Let me just go to, we're good? At the end of this series, so excited. Last time I had to get this mic, last gathering. So I told him I was going to be like a TV evangelist. It was awesome. We had a lot of fun. I sold like some prayer towels at the end. It was great. Just kidding. Bad joke. We're so glad to have you guys here with us this morning. If you're watching online, it's really, this series has been fun. It's been awesome. And this was my favorite song for them to do. I love, if you haven't seen the movie The Greatest Showman, that's one of the songs out of that movie. It's a really good movie, and it's about the life of P.T. Barnum. And the whole concept behind that song is P.T. has been chasing, like trying, he grew up super poor, and he's been trying to make something of himself, and he's been trying to figure out a way to become like successful in the world's eyes, and so he wants to be with all these big wigs, and he wants to like try to figure out how to create something new and big, and he just always wants to try to go one more step further, and in it, somewhere along the way, he realizes like he's losing the thing that's most important to him. He's losing his family. He's losing his wife. And there's this moment of revelation, of realization that, man, the thing that matters the most, I'm losing in the pursuit of the things that I thought were what was important. And the reason I like the song, the reason that movie is because I feel like that's a lot of times what we're doing in our culture, in the American culture, is we're so like set on just pursuing the next thing that makes us feel more successful, like one more, you know, raise in our pay, or one more big vacation, or new toy, or we're looking for the next relationship to make us feel like this relationship's finally going to make me feel like I'm successful, and we feel like it's standards are out there that we're trying to reach, and we are trying to equate ourselves to everybody else, and you know, it's like we think that our life is a trophy, like we want to try to get that trophy and make it to be as pretty and as nice and as tall as possible, because some reason we think at the end of life we're going to take our trophy and we're going to go to the trophy room and put it in front of everybody else's trophies. And we're just wondering where our trophy is going to line up compared to all the other trophies it's going to be sitting on. Is it going to be really short, or it's going to have like a really pretty person on the top, like some wings? I don't know. We're like struggling with that, you know? We struggle with trying to figure out what life is and is about, and how we don't just get caught up in the rat race. And I think quite honestly, that sometimes we miss the thing in that pursuit that's the most important. And so I want to take some time this morning and just focus on that. And it's this concept that is in Christianity that we hear quite a lot. In fact, some of the most famous songs sing about it. It's this idea of grace. This idea of grace. I think that grace is the most important, most beautiful thing we can wrap our mind around as followers of Christ. And really, in our lives, to be able to live a life that we enjoy, but that also matters when it matters most. So I thought I'd take a moment to explain grace to you in a way that makes sense to me. I'm a big guy, shocker. There's like, according to who you are, there's certain graces allotted to you for certain things and certain people, you know? Like, we give certain graces to, like, you know, if like a six-month-old, like, pitches a fit, like, in the middle of the store, like, we're like, six-month-old. But, like, if, you know, a 16-year-old, like, got down and did the same thing, we'd be like, oh, no, this ain't gonna happen. What's going on here, right? And there's this grace given to this six-month-old. It's not given to a 16-year-old. It's definitely not given to 41-year-olds. I tried it last week, did not work, all right? So, like, you know, there's certain graces that are given to certain people. Well, I've always gotten some graces. I'm a big guy, so there's, like, what I call the big guy graces that you get, all right? Like, for instance, when I walk into a restaurant, most time if they have tables or booths, people ask you, hey, sir, would you like a table or a booth? They just know, like, oh, this guy wants a table. It's a grace. It's given to me, right? I don't have to worry about how close I am to that table. It's just a grace. If I'm going somewhere with some friends and there's like three of us traveling, they're like, oh, a lot of times like, hey, Q, you got the front seat, man. It's just, you know, it's just grace. Like, they don't want to be squished in the back seat with me, so it's like, let's let Q have the front seat. It's just some grace given to me. And I was taught, you know, I don't, in the Bible it's weird because Jesus doesn't say the word grace very often in the Bible, in the Gospels. But It's like permeated all throughout his life that he lives and the stories he tells. Like we see it all these different places. But I remember when I really think I understood grace most clearly. And so I want to share that with you guys this morning as we get into, and I want to take some time looking at one of Jesus' stories. When I was in fifth grade, I had this amazing teacher named Mrs. Luther. I don't know, did anybody else in here ever have Mrs. Luther? She was an incredible teacher. And I'll never forget my first day at school in Mrs. Luther class. I went in there, and she was playing on this piano in the middle of her class. And I thought, this is going to be the greatest year ever. She was playing Pink Panther. She's going, ba-da, 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 ba-da. Like, I didn't even know that until I went to her class, and I started hearing it all the time. And then halfway through the day, she got up, and she started dancing on top of her piano, y'all. And this, she was not like a young teacher, right? She'd been in this game for a while, okay? And she's up dancing. And I don't know, if you want to like get my attention, just find a piano and dance on it. My attention's going to be on you. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know what else is going on in the world. Like, but there could be like oil changes happening over here. There could be people like doing that. But if you're dancing on a piano, I'm like, oh, something interesting's happening. This person's dancing on a piano. And from that moment on, I was like zeroed in. Miss Luther was like my favorite teacher. I loved everything she did. Except this one thing she did. She did this thing that she called her May Day and Sadie Hawkins Day celebrations. Now, what would happen is on May Day, we'd go out to the field. She would pull her lifted truck. She had like a four-wheel drive truck that was lifted. She'd pull it to the edge of the field, the PE field. And on May Day, she would honk the horn. And as she honked the horn, the girls would start running. And then she'd honk the horn a second time, and then the boys would start running. And if you tagged one of the girls, then the next day you would do a fake wedding with them. I don't think that's PC anymore. That probably gets us in trouble at the schools these days. But that's what we did, right? We had these, like, fake weddings. Now, here's the thing. Again, I'm a big guy, which gives me some graces, but it also has some disadvantages. The one being of which I'm not a runner. It's just not my thing. Like, if you're like, Hugh, do you want to go for a jog after church today? I mean, I'm not going, you know? It's not going to happen. Like, if you want to, like, hey, Hugh, do you want to go eat? Yeah, probably. Yeah, I'll do that. But I'm probably not going running with you, you know? But, so in my mind, I'm like, oh, man. There's this one girl that was in my class. Y'all, and she was, the fifth grader, she was everything, right? Beautiful, nice, had a sweet voice, like one of those sweet fifth grade girl voices, you know, like just like everything. But I knew I couldn't catch her. She's way faster than me. And I just almost couldn't stand it because then I started being like, I don't even know who I can catch. And I don't know if I want to catch who I can catch, you know, like then there's that. Like, I don't know if I want to catch them. And this is all, again, fifth grade mind going through my head, right? And so then I came up with this idea. I went to Mrs. Luther and I said, hey, what if I officiate the weddings tomorrow? You know? And she's like, oh, okay, that sounds good. We'll have you officiate the wedding. So all you who are thinking about my ministerial experience, been doing weddings since the fifth grade, all right? Just so you know that. All right, I've got some experience here. And so I didn't have to worry about who was, I didn't run. I was like, the preacher, you know, doing these weddings is awesome, right? Which is fine. And I come in, we officiate these, fine. I make it through the day. Well, then the day comes where the girls are going to chase the guys. And I go in with the same confidence that week before that's going to go in to Miss Luther and go, hey, you want me to officiate those weddings again? She goes, no, I think I want you to run this time. And I went, oh, my gosh. Because I'm just going to tell you how my fifth grade brain worked in that moment. My first thought was, oh, my gosh, man, there's some people in here that run faster than me. They're girls that I do not want tagging me. I do not want to marry them. Like, it's like I just don't want them to tag me. I don't want to be getting married to these people. This is not good. I don't know what I'm going to do. And then the second thought was a little worse. The second thought was like, what if nobody tags me? Like, what if I run and nobody tags me on purpose? And so I think I had like cold sweats that night as I went to bed before. But I started praying a prayer that night. And this is the prayer. It was something like this. Like, God, can you make me fast faster than lightning for some reason? I just decided I was going to run. Could you somehow give me super speed like you gave Samson super strength? And I'm just going to run as hard as I can. Went to school the next day. I didn't even eat lunch. I was like, I ain't putting no more weight on. Like, you know what? We're going to be streamlined as fast as I can be. No more weight. I'm going to run this thing. All right. And get up there, and it's time, and we all line up. And she hits that first horn, and I take off. And I feel it in my bones that God has given me some kind of super speed. I don't know. I'm like looking. I'm focused. I'm not even looking behind me. I'm just like, oh, nobody's catching me. You know, I have zeroed in. I feel like this is amazing. This is going to be great. I'm not going to get tagged, and I'm going to sit up here and let everybody look at my big man speed. It's going to be awesome. And so I'm running. I'm tearing down through there. Nothing. No tags. No nothing. You know, I feel like I've got a good speed, and I hear the second horn, so I know they've been released now, and I'm running, and I'm like, oh, don't catch me. And then about three quarters of the way across the field, I feel somebody tap me on the shoulder. And I just got this sinking feeling inside, like, oh, no, what is happening? And I turned around, and that girl that I thought I could never catch has tagged me. And that was the first time I think I understood grace. She wasn't romantically attracted to me. She just knew that I didn't have a chance otherwise. And she gave me grace. I remember marrying her and thinking, I wish this was real. It wasn't. But there was this grace that was shown in that moment. And I think, man, sometimes we're like, I just want to run this race as hard as I can. I just want to be as successful as possible. And we're thinking, like, whatever it takes, I'm just going to run. I don't care. But I wonder if we'd allow it, if grace would reach out and maybe grab us this morning, if we can be reminded about how beautiful grace really is. So I want to share a story that Jesus shares in Scripture. And it's one that you're going to be pretty aware with if you've read anything or been to church a couple times. If you haven't, this is probably one of the most popular stories we hear a lot, and it's the story of the prodigal son. So this is how it goes. It says, Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. So he divided his property between them. All right, so there's these two sons, and their dad, and this is the younger son, comes and he wants his inheritance, what he wants. He's asking for his inheritance. Now, you usually get inheritance after your parent has died, after your father has died. But he wants his inheritance then. Probably would have been about one-third. The older son always gets kind of double what the younger son gets. So probably would have been about one-third of the inheritance that the older son, or one-third that this younger son would have gotten. And it really what he's saying is like, I don't want to wait for you to die, Dad. I think I can figure this out on my own right now. So I want to act like you've already died, Dad, and give me what's mine, and let me go do what I want to do. I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to make it. I'm going to find my success. I'm going to make something of myself, Dad. I don't need you to be around here still and doing the things you want to do. I'm going to go figure out that I'm going to go be somebody. All right? And so he takes it. He gets it. And we don't know the exact amount, but it would have been we know that his dad has servants and stuff, so we would know he had been fairly wealthy. It had been a significant amount. This wouldn't have been like he got $200 and said, hey, go on your way. This would have been thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars that he would have gotten to kind of go start out life and to make something of himself, all right? So he gets it, and it says, not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in the country, and he began to be in need. So he gets his property, he goes out, and we see that he engages in what they call reckless living, right? Now, I don't know what this looked like at the time. Maybe he made some like bad investments. Maybe instead of getting like economy car, he decided to get him like a upgrade and get some like real fancy, you know, Maybe he got like the most fancy, you know, I don't know, whatever fancy today. What, those trucks are worth like $60,000 now. Maybe he got one of those trucks and like he like upgraded then, and then he got the nice penthouse, and then maybe he like, you know, went out and started betting and gambling, thinking like he wanted to be a big shot. Maybe he was wearing like the most expensive shoes and he had the designer clothes on. I don't know, but it was in reckless living. He had spent everything. And what's crazy is then the severe famine comes. And here's what I want you to understand is that when we live life, it doesn't matter how well you think you're doing. You may be going out there and you may be making more money, having more things that you want, and you may think that you're like succeeding in this amazing way. When famine comes, we all feel it. We just do. And the famine comes, and he begins to be in need. He begins to be able to not have enough to take care of himself. So he's went out there, he's got from his dad what he was owing his inheritance. He has now wrecked that and ruined it, and now he finds himself in need. So he has an idea, which honestly, not a bad one. It says, so he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. So he decides, I need to go find a job. And he finds one where he's feeding pigs. And what's crazy is he's gone from a place where he's with his dad, and now he's tried to make it, and he's failed miserably. And now he's out here eating or feeding pigs, and it says that he is so hungry that he longs to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate. He starts thinking, maybe I can just eat this. Like, I'm so hungry, maybe I'll just eat this right here. And as he's there and he's thinking that, a thought comes to him. So as he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? So he has this really good thought. He goes, I'm struggling. I'm wanting to eat what these pigs are eating, but I know at least my dad's servants get fed every day. And he has this aha moment. I can go back and just be a servant. I've already taken my inheritance as a son. I've ruined that relationship, but if I could just convince him, maybe have a little bit of mercy, then I could go back and be a servant. Isn't that crazy? Sometimes in life, we start trying to chase these things. We start trying to make our lives feel a certain way, and then we just feel like, man, we just feel like we need God sometimes to just show us a little bit of mercy. We get to a point where we're like, God, I just need a little bit of mercy. This is too much right now. I'm struggling here. This is too much. I need just a little bit of mercy. And this is the thought he has. My father will be me. He'll just give me some mercy. He'll let me be a servant. And so he does what probably any of us would have done at this moment. He begins rehearsing what he's going to say. This is a big moment. He's going to be having a conversation with the person that he is probably shamed more than anybody. He says, I will rise and go to my father, and I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he probably repeats this over and over in his head. He's probably trying to figure out how to say this the right way. He's like, you know, he's really trying to make sure he's got this line worked out that, hey, I know I've sinned against heaven and you. I mean, by the way, that's a great line, right? He didn't just tell his father, I've sinned against you. I've sinned against heaven and you. Like, he's really trying to be big and realize, hey, I know I've messed up. Can I just be a servant? And he practices it. And you can imagine him walking back to where his dad's property was and him just saying this over and over in his head. Father, I know I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be your son. May I just be one of your servants? And he just keeps saying it, just keeps saying it, dreading the moment he's going to have to actually look his father in the eye and say those words. And so on his way, it says that he arose and he came to his father's. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. This is so good. So here's what happens is while he was still a long way off, his father saw him. His father saw him. And what did his father feel? His father felt compassion. Now, what's crazy about this is his father was looking for him. His father was trying to somehow pay attention, hoping, maybe even thinking his son might come back. He sees him, and then he runs out to him and embraces him and kisses him. The expectation we might have in that moment is that he would expect his son to come to him and maybe grovel. Or maybe his son would come back and kind of prove, like, hey, I know I messed up. Here's what I need to do. Like, there would be all these things. Are these expectations? Okay, you want to come back? here's some things you got to do. You want to come back, you got to do this much work for these many years, and we'll get back to where you've earned your spot back here in the Father's house. If you can do enough good work that makes enough profit, then everything will be good, and you'll be back in good graces here in my household. But this is not what the Father does. The Father runs to him, embraces him, and kisses him. He shows compassion on him. And then he goes further and says this. The son says to him, Father, he says his line, right? He had practiced his line. He's going to say his line. Father, I've sinned against heaven before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But before he can add the part, just let me be a servant, right? It says, but the father said to his servants, before he can say, I want to be a servant, the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. This is grace. This is the most powerful thing that God gives. This is the gift that God gives to us. And we try to sometimes figure out how to make religion like be the thing that fixes us. Religion will not fix you. There's no amount of set of rules that you can live to be good enough to earn anything from God. And you can't do enough bad things to ever make God give up on you because of grace. Grace is so beautiful. It's so engaging, so intoxicating. Grace is such a big thing that it's the crux of our faith. In fact, there were some folks one time that were meeting at a college in England, and they met for the sole purpose in the 1950s. They were trying to figure out what really sets Christianity apart from other religions. And they had some debates on that. They said, hey, well, what about the idea of a Messiah? And they're like, well, there's other religions who talk about a Messiah. They said, what about the resurrection? And there's actually other faiths that talk about they have the idea of a resurrection. And C.S. Lewis happens to walk in. He wasn't part of the conversation. C.S. Lewis, a great theologian who wrote the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, all the Narnia stuff. He wrote a lot of books. Was an atheist for a while and then came back to God. He walks into the room and he says, what are you guys discussing? And they pose him the same question. And here's what C.S. Lewis, he says, C.S. Lewis almost chuckles. He goes, well, that's easy. What sets the Christian faith apart is grace. It's grace. So all these other religions will tell you have to follow a certain set of laws or a path, or you have to do so much good deeds to earn whatever gets you next up in the level of their faith, to go to the next level, to go to their heaven, all that, to be reincarnated. There's like certain things you have to do. But what the Christian faith says is this: there is nothing you can do to earn it. It is grace. It is grace that is given to you. There is nothing you can do. You cannot be good enough to be one of Jesus's. You cannot do that. It doesn't matter. And some of it's so hard for us because we've thought all along, well, if I go to enough church services, or if I read enough scripture, or if I do enough Bible studies, then maybe I'll be good enough for God. Or we thought, if I can at least raise my kids to know who God is, then maybe I'll be good enough for God. You cannot be good enough for God. It's grace. We're all born into sin, this pride that exists inside of us. We're all born into it. We've all messed up. We've all done bad things. We've all chased the wrong stuff. We've all separated ourselves from God. But grace is the thing calling us back. It's the thing singing the song to us that's trying to sing our hearts back to where they belong. It's the grace of God. In this moment, we see where the Father shows grace. He puts a ring on his hand, signifying, you will never be a servant. You will always be my son. The ring on his finger signifies him as a son. He puts the robe on in the royalty. He puts the shoes on his feet. And then they begin to celebrate. And this is the theme that runs throughout the scriptures. In fact, there's this one time that Peter asked this question. You want to know what grace looks like? It's such a beautiful thing. Peter asked this question to Jesus. He goes, Jesus, should we forgive those who do wrong against us? Should we forgive them 7 times? And Peter thought he was being like really nice in that moment when he said 7 times. Because the rabbis of the day would say you had to forgive someone 3 times. That was the expectation. You had to forgive someone 3 times. So he's more than doubling. Like he's doing a little more than double of what the rabbis would say, and thinking he's saying something good. Hey, because that's the way we live life, is in math. We think, if I do enough good, if I can forgive somebody seven times, then I'm a good person. So now I'm a good person, so now I'm good with God. None of that gets you good with God. In fact, Jesus is so, like, he gets the mindset that Peter's in. You know what Jesus says back to him? He says, no, not seven. What about 70 times seven? You know? And they tried to do that math in their head, and they couldn't do it. I don't even know if they had times back then. I don't know where their math was like back then. They tried to get out the abacus and go, oh, gosh, man, what is this, you know? How many times do I forgive these? What Jesus was saying is, like, there's not a limit on this. Like, it's grace. It's grace. Like, you can't forgive people enough to be good enough for me. Like, it's great. Like, you're not going to forget. You're not going to be some super forgiver, and then you're, like, awesome and perfect in God's eyes. It doesn't happen. Your sin still exists there. See, we live in this world, all we're trying to calculate, can I do enough good things? Can I be a good person? So many times I've heard people say, man, but they're such a good person. None of us really good people. Not really. Like, we can make people think we're good people. I do that all the time, right? But we all know our stuff. We all know our deep down thoughts and the badness of us. We all get it. That's why the Christian faith is so great. It's because of the grace that exists there. And what Jesus, what is written in Romans about it, when Paul begins to write about this grace, he says that grace is a free gift of God. A free gift. See, in our lostness, in our struggle to try to act like we matter, to try to figure out how we can be good enough or matter in this world, as we try to create our trophies and stack them up in the trophy room of life, God's been sitting there with a gift the whole time saying, hey, you want to really live? It's grace. It's grace. And all we've had to do is go get that gift and begin to unwrap it. See, that gift was given to us when Christ came and he lived a perfect life and he died on the cross. And then 3 days later, he rose again. And that whole moment when he's taken into Jerusalem and he knows he's dying, he's beaten, he's whipped, he's mocked, they pull out his beard, they put a crown of thorns on his head. When all that nastiness is going on, Jesus knows this is the gift of grace. This is the moment when Jesus can now reconnect humanity back to God. Because God, throughout the Gospels, when Jesus talks about grace, he's telling stories of where God is super excited for us to find the gift of grace. For us to find, for him to be reconnected with us. He tells a story of when this lady finds this coin. It says she's so excited. She searches the whole house for a coin. She finds the coin and she throws a party and invites everybody over. Talks about when the shepherd who has 99 sheep and he's got one lost sheep and he goes and finds a sheep, puts it on his shoulder, comes back and throws a party over the one sheep. And he says all of heaven celebrates when one that was lost is found. This is the heart of God. Grace is what God is all about. He's not about trying to make sure we follow every law to be good enough. That's not who God is. All that was set up throughout history so that when Christ come, we would see the beauty of grace, that we could never be good enough. We would never match up to any standard God has. We would never be good enough for God, but grace through Christ would save us. The grace would save us. And that's what salvation is. It's walking up to that gift. Accepting the grace. That's it. It's not being any certain kind of person or figuring out how to do it a certain way. It's just taking that grace, accepting it. What do we do with it, right? Like, we got our hands up. I got a bottom line for this morning. This says that with grace, what we're supposed to do is acknowledge grace and be grateful. That's what we do. We acknowledge the grace, and then we're grateful for the grace that we have experienced. Now, if you have been saved, there's become a point in your life where you acknowledge and that grace, you accepted that gift. But if you haven't done that, if you're like, Q, I don't know if I'm saved. If you're watching out there and you're like, I don't know if I'm saved. Look, it's not like a difficult, laborious process. For anybody that's told you had to look a certain way or dress a certain way or be a certain way, or your hair couldn't be but a certain length, or you had to wear certain clothes, or you couldn't have tattoos, or I don't know, whatever anybody's tried to tell you before, none of that is what gets us saved. Salvation comes through faith by grace. It is the belief in that gift of grace. That is all that will save you. That's all that will ever save you. It is the grace of God through Christ. And if you want to know, you just accept it. You believe in that gift, and you will be saved. God is longing to find the people who will accept the gift of grace. It's what the gospel is talking about the whole way through, looking for someone to experience that gift of grace. And that's salvation. Now, if you're a believer and you've been saved, then the question becomes, what are you doing with the grace? What are you doing with it? My fear is that if grace was an actual object, I don't know what it would be. Let's say it was a bowling ball. That sounds fun. But if grace was a bowling ball, I think we have buried it in our closets. It's not that we didn't, like, a lot of us believers didn't really appreciate it at one point, right? Like, we opened the gift. We loved it. We even put it on a shelf for a while. We talked about how amazing it was. We even, like, sang songs about it. And those songs, the first time, like after we experienced grace and the first time we sung about the amazing grace, it really moved us and did something inside of us. But somewhere along the way, it's like we set it down and said, hey, I'll come back and get it, but I got to do a few things. I got to be somebody. I've got to go out and make something in my life. Look, grace, I'm going to come back to you, grace. I got to get some things done. Got to handle a few things. And somewhere along the line, we quit living in gratitude of grace. We quit being grateful for the grace that God's given us, and it just becomes some afterthought that every now and then we remember. But we don't live in full grace. You know how I know that? Because so many of us are living lives, myself included, are living lives where we're trying so hard to feel like we matter. We're trying so hard to be successful, to whatever successful looks like. We're trying, and it was ingrained in us from a young age, like make the best grades, be the best on the team. Look, I get it. Like we want to do everything we do for the glory of God, but it wasn't just, we weren't told to do everything to do for the glory of God. We were told you be your best because if you're the best, you matter more. And so some reason holding on to grace has become hard for us because we keep thinking we've got to somehow prove ourselves to the rest of the world. And we're running so hard. And it used to be like small moments we would not live with grace, but grace, sometimes we'll go days, weeks, even I dare say some of us believers go years without letting grace be the centrality of who we are. We'll get so caught up. We'll think we're better than this person based on how many times we went to church versus how many times they went to church. We'll think that person's so far away from God because of their actions, not believing that grace could reach them. It's because we've distanced ourselves from the grace that saved us. And I just wonder, believers, look, I know we run hard in this world, in this culture, but I just wonder this morning if you could just focus on how beautiful that grace was when you first found it. How that grace changed everything. How that grace, like realizing that someone loved you no matter how good you were, changed everything. That you didn't have to prove yourself to God or be good enough to be in God's graces. He just gave you the gift because He made you and He loved you. That first moment, that first experience, how we're supposed to live. We're supposed to acknowledge that grace and be grateful for it. And when we're grateful for grace, here's what that looks like. We pour the grace down to the people underneath us. We become more gracious the more we live full of grace. We can handle more. The world doesn't make us so upside down. We don't get so angry so easy because we're holding on to the grace that saved us. It's central to who we are. We're like, man, I know, like that person's been a total, butthole to me, but God loves me, so I'm going to love them. Like we are able to do that. We're able to show more grace when we're living with grace. And I know some of you are running so hard, but I wonder if you can just feel it this morning. If you could feel it, I promise you, no matter how hard you're running, Jesus will tap you on the shoulder. And if you turn around, you'll find grace waiting for you. Man, I ran that day in fifth grade as hard as any fifth grade big boy could ever run. If I'd have failed, it would have been bad. And I expected the worst when I got tapped on the shoulder. and I found the best. Some of you guys are running so hard. Some of you watching are running so hard out there. But if you turn around, God's grace never leaves you. You'll find His grace waiting for you. You just got to accept it. You just got to live with it. Take the gift. Accept it. Acknowledge it. Just be grateful. It can change everything for you. I want to pray, and then the band's going to come, and then if you haven't ever accepted that grace, it's really simple. You can just pray. You can pray, Jesus, please, I want to accept the gift of grace. I believe that Your Son came to save me, that He died, He rose again. And would you allow me to be saved and accept the grace that You offer me? If you're a believer, maybe you need to be looking back over that shoulder and going, I got to stop. I got to begin to live in grace again instead of trying to live in my own power and live for my own purposes. I need to live in grace. Let me pray for you. God, thank You so much for this morning, and I pray that grace, that Your grace would never stop just transforming us, affecting us, moving us, shaping us, that Your grace would be all over who we are and continue to dictate how we live, God. It's so easy to get caught up in the race of this life, God. It's so easy to get caught up in trying to prove that we're good enough or make something of ourselves or be the best, whatever that means, God. But at the end of the day, what's so beautiful is that You love us. You just love us, God. We don't have to prove anything to You. It's not that we have to like change ourselves to come to You, God. We just get to take the gift of grace and accept it. And in that accepting of it and being grateful for it and living in it, God, all the changes that need to happen in our lives just happen. We don't have to find the checklist anymore, God. We just have to live in Your grace and Your salvation. And God, if there's people here who have not experienced or are watching online who've never come to that saving knowledge of Your grace, I pray this morning they would just say a simple prayer saying, God, I believe in Your grace. I believe that You sent Jesus to die for me, that He rose again, that He paid my debt. God, they would come to know You. And God, for those who believe, I pray they would feel Your tap of Your Holy Spirit on their shoulder. They could turn around and see grace one more time. We love You. We pray this in Jesus' name.